Welcome to the Omni Gamers Club podcast for games of all platforms, including playing lawn games on the grounds of your English manor. I am Daniel Winter.
And I'm Mark Uesa.
How are you, Mark?
I'm well. Yeah, I'm just coming back from short vacation. I was actually playing some lawn games myself, but this time in a resort pool area in hot Las Vegas.
I was going to say, there's lots of other sort of games to be playing in Las Vegas.
Certainly, yeah, and I might talk a little bit about those as well. But this time it was cornhole, which seems to be at every resort. And there was gigantic Tetris as well, which I played with my kids. Fun. So that counts as a board game.
How does, like, actual digital Tetris? Like an arcade game version? Or
I totally crossed the wires in my mind, but I'm talking about Jenga. It was gigantic
Jenga. Giant Jenga. That makes sense.
It has bricks. You stack them,
Excellent. So as of this episode, we're going to try something a little bit different in splitting up the segments, at least separating the featured game discussion into its own episode. It's for a few reasons. It lets us keep a more regular schedule. We can release an episode once a week and also just reduce the play length of each episode to a more manageable length, a little less intimidating. I know my podcast backlog is certainly building up. So yeah, let us know if you have any thoughts on that. But hopefully this makes everything a little more streamlined for you.
That's right. Keep it bite-sized. Keep the conversation going. For sure. So shall we roll into it?
Yeah, so this episode is just going to be the news and the playlist, which is all the other games we've been playing. And then as its own separate episode, we'll release our featured game, or in this case, a double feature. And we'll be discussing Botany Manor and Harold Halibut. So that's going to be its own separate episode. Keep an eye out for that about a week after this episode drops.
That's right. It's going to be a good discussion.
Looking forward to it in a week. So, Mark, what's news to you?
Yeah, I'll start us off with some late news, because I think we'll be talking about a heavier news segment that some listening might be able to guess. Yeah, so I talked about Las Vegas. Let me say a couple things about the games that I played there. There's a bunch of good arcades in Las Vegas.
Interesting, yeah.
So some of you who may not be aware, there's three-ish notable ones. There's probably more. Circus Circus is probably the arcade that's been around for a while. I'll tell you a little bit about the video game arcade that I went to with my kids at New York, New York.
Hmm.
So New York is a sort of center strip. As you can imagine, it's themed after the city that never sleeps, the other city that never sleeps on the East Coast. And it's got great food. It's got this giant roller coaster. It's got a miniature Statue of Liberty. And it has this actually really decent video arcade, mostly newer games. I didn't see a lot of retro titles there, but that's fine for my kids. There's like crane games. There's VR games. There's, you know, retro titles in the sense of there's, you know, the classics like Skee-Ball. There's air hockey. There's, you know, sit down Mario Kart, but they also have like newer-ish ones. There are, you know, like Crossy Roads, the giant ones, you know, the video game app.
Yeah.
And they had like this various like Price is Right sort of a game show type giant size activities. And they had this antique crane game, like a crane game you might win a stuffed animal from. But the crane game was like floor to ceiling, and you could basically like crawl in there.
There's one giant animal in there.
Yeah, there's many giant animals in there, and my youngest kid was very tempted, so I had to go there. But man, is it ever a racket? Like, I think we paid a decent amount of money. Yeah.
That kind of racket. Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. We wanted to give our kids a chance to kind of go wild. And it's pretty much the same as like gambling on the casino floor. In both cases, you go up to a machine, you get delivered this plastic card in which you put real money in and you get virtual credits out. So you don't realize how fast you're spending your money. Every game charges a certain amount of credits, which are these mysterious values like 15 and 30 and 70, and who knows what those convert to. And then I don't know if you're familiar, a lot of the like Chuck E. Cheese style arcades have like tickets that you win, right?
Yeah.
And so you win the tickets out of the machines. And at first I was like, where are the tickets? This is kind of weird. But of course, you're winning.
Oh, the digital. Yeah.
Just like the physical casinos are stored on your digital card. So that part was a little bit disappointing. There's something to be said about having like a pile, like an armload.
A reel of tickets.
Yeah, exactly, of physical tickets. There was actually, in a strange sort of meta gaming scenario, there was a crane game in which you could win rolls of tickets.
Interesting.
So you like, there was literal rolls in the crane game that you had to scoop out. So that one kind of blew my mind. The one thing we were remarking upon as we left, and we did have a good time, that the machines were generally newer, really slick. It was like kind of cool, well lit in there. Decent prizes, but of course you're not going to win enough tickets to get them.
Well, did your kids end up with any prizes by the end of it?
Yeah, yeah. Actually, with the meager amount of points that they had, like, you can always convert it down into candy.
Yes.
So if you're going to go on a vacation there anyways, you know, might as well let
about 100% markup. Well, I mean, like, yeah. 100 times markup.
So you can always convert it down into candies and doodads and this and that, which they certainly did. But we all had fun. But if you enjoy a little bit of video games and your gambling's not your thing, you can always hunt down a fun arcade. There's a few on the strip.
I've taken my daughter to a local arcade every 2 or 3 months. It's at the Cineplex, instead of the big movie theater.
They're
growing out the arcade scene now. And there's the one I've gotten hooked on personally is the coin drop. I don't know if you've seen those.
Yeah. That's like literal gambling.
Exactly, yeah. But that's I can see the appeal. I don't gamble, but that's my hit that I need. Yeah, I need to do one of those every
year. Those coin drop games are huge in, like, especially in Japan, like in those Konami or Taito run arcades.
There's pachinko machines.
Yeah, they're
similar, but
sometimes, yeah. There's dedicated pachinko parlors, there's dedicated slots places. Sometimes there's pachinko and slots, but even at the kids-oriented game centers, you find those coin drop games. But you find like Metal Gear Solid themed ones, and you find
Evangelion themed ones. Yeah, I think like a Rick and Morty one that I was playing. So you only walk past and you see like a huge buildup of the coins. Like, I can get it. I can get a stockpile there.
Everyone thinks that.
You got to get some tickets, enough tickets to get for the kid to get something, and she usually gets a little tchotchke of some kind. So
right, yeah, it's a racket.
To be honest, I will say that it's been pretty affordable. Like, the actual prizes are not valuable at all.
Yeah.
But you can usually, for $10, you can get an hour of fun one way or another and without too much expense.
I totally understand the prizes and the tchotchkes for kids is so that you don't leave with them crying and begging you to buy them something, right? It's like you've already spent the money, so at least they leave with something. It's the literal consolation prize. On that note, I'm going to mention one more thing quickly, because it's not that deep, before we move into bigger news, is that sort of game related, and sort of related to a game you've been playing, is I started watching the Dragon's Dogma show, the anime, on Netflix. So
Dragon's Dogma anime? I did not hear about this.
There is, I think it's only a single season, so like 8 or 10 episodes. It's like... okay, like, it's moderate. It's very derivative of lots of other sort of like lone swordsman Avenger sort of like manga stories that you might think, like Berserk or whatnot. But it has some interesting connections to the video game. I haven't played that much of the video game, but I'm aware of, you know, basically how the pawn system works. And there's two primary characters, the sort of the hero who has his heart ripped out, which is like literally happens in Dragon's Dogma 1, at least in the first few minutes. Similarly, it's not the same character. It's not the same character. It's not exactly the same character setup, but it's close enough that, you know, any viewer would totally understand. They're making sort of a parallel.
So does it introduce you to that world and setting pretty well?
Yeah, definitely. It's its own story though. But all the sort of the tropes of the game are there.
Okay.
And the pawn, who is this sort of like the secondary character, is probably like the only other like main character is the pawn. Her name is Hana, and she is really interesting. Like, they cover her in an interesting way. She's obviously sort of unhuman, like in the way that the pawns are like these sort of weird.
In theory, they're supposed to be like a separate race of from another plane of existence or something.
They don't explain it very well, but she sort of like acts like, you know, Commander Data from Star Trek The Next Generation or something. She's like humanoid form. She kind of like second guesses everything that the humans do and says like, I don't understand this. This is illogical. But as the series goes on, and I've only watched up until episode 6 or something like that, her character sort of grows and she shows more and more like human sides. And obviously her relationship to the Arisen develops further as well. And he's sort of less of an interesting character than the pawn. He's sort of your stereotypical, like, I got to get revenge. Yeah. Sort of character. I don't even remember his name, but he goes on a journey as well. He goes sort of on this up and down emotional journey, and she's sort of there to like regulate him, which is like a kind of interesting relationship, right? So I thought that was interesting enough. If anyone was playing Dragon's Dogma 1 or 2 and is just curious to if they also watch anime, you might want to just turn that on and try it out.
So is this new, or is this from the time of the first game?
It is not new. It's not brand new. It's not like coinciding with Dragon's Dogma 2 whatsoever. Mm. I knew it was there for some time, and it was just sort of on my watch list. And just because you had been talking about Dragon's Dogma 2, and I wanted to encourage myself to play 1 a little bit more, I just turned it on. And it's interesting enough, very like stereotypical fantasy stuff, but with enough of connections to the video game that it makes it somewhat interesting.
Interesting. I don't know that world is the most interesting part of that game to want to drag me into it, but I'll take a look.
Yeah, it's like interesting in the sense of like it's a Dungeons and Dragons sort of like parallel, right? It's like if you like generic low magic fantasy, low fantasy, then it's there for you.
Excellent. So I don't want to turn this podcast into the studio closure, games layoff watch, but there is a particularly egregious case this last week I wanted to discuss at least briefly, and that is that Microsoft has closed another couple of studios. Actually, they closed like 4 studios, I think it was, 2 of which were smaller mobile studios. But the 2 big ones were Arkane Austin, makers of most recently Redfall, but also Prey. Which is a personal favorite, and also Tango Gameworks, who most recently made Hi-Fi Rush, which we featured as an episode here. The Evil Within, Ghostwire Tokyo, quite a well-known studio, but both of them were. This is a bit of a surprise, especially considering Hi-Fi Rush having been pretty well lauded with various awards and critical acclaim this last year. I don't know how much, like, how successful it was economically. Microsoft had previously said that it exceeded their expectations, so I don't know what more they're looking for here. So I see a lot of factors with how these studios are being managed, but it's a little unfortunate to see this trend growing in these big companies consolidate studios under one big umbrella and then just cutting them down the moment it's inconvenient.
Right. Yeah, I was shaken by this news as well, and it's not like we haven't heard of this before. It's also not just a Microsoft thing. Obviously, Sony has had their share of layoffs recently,
and Embracer too. Embracer has been closing.
That's right. Lots of industries have, but video games this year hasn't even, isn't even half done yet. But it's been rocked by so many of these layoffs that I think a lot of people are feeling rightfully worried about the health of the industry, the health of their chosen careers, if they happen to be in the games industry, and definitely some concerns about the worth of supporting these larger video game platforms, not just Microsoft, but Sony as well. Nintendo is not blameless as well. They have been known to treat some of their developers and contractors not very well, especially when crunch is involved. And also, ironically, they're among the least consumer-friendly of the main platform holders with their re-releases and their gouging the end user. But somehow, they get off scot-free in terms of the public court of public opinion. So the thing that these layoffs made me think of most of all was that I had a lot of faith in Microsoft as the, I thought, naively, maybe the most consumer friendly of the major platform holders. I also naively was very sort of in support of the Activision Blizzard acquisition. You know, I thought this is going to be great. I'm going to get access to Diablo 4. We're going to get, you know, more RPGs under the belt. And these are the games I like. So I want them on Game Pass and everything's going to be hunky dory. But when I hear about, you know, the closure of like really studios like Arcane, not Leon, because Leon is still running.
Yes. Yeah.
But Arcane, what was it? Texas?
Austin. Arcane Austin.
Austin, yeah. Texas. Yeah. So, like such notable studios like them and Tango Gameworks, their own, I believe the only Japanese studio, their portfolio.
Yeah, that sounds about right. I can't fact check them offhand, but yeah.
Yeah, I feel like none of these platform holders, Sony, Microsoft, or Nintendo, are your friend, right?
No.
And I certainly feel that more strongly than ever right now. And neither is Steam. So if anyone is, you know, tempted fanboy out about this, like, you got very little, a solid ground to stand on there. Yeah. I feel really down about it all, to be honest.
It's tough because AAA game development has really ballooned in the time and cost it takes to make these games. And they just don't want to seem to have the patience to actually give games that time, right? They want to consolidate all these names under one umbrella, but not actually manage them and give them the time it needs to get the final product out there. Unfortunately, like they bought these studios, let them release a game and then drop them rather than let them move on to the next thing, right? They got what they needed, they got a product, and then it's too much effort to just,
yeah. And if you think about it, this should have been even more predictable in the way that a lot of these, if you look at streaming platforms, right? If you look at these streaming platforms and these studio acquisitions in Hollywood, they have, you know, taken like finished films like the Batwoman movie, or I think there was a what was it,
the another Wile E. Coyote. Brothers,
right, the Wile E. Coyote movie. Like someone, you know, spent years of their lives working on that, and these titles get shuttered and don't see the light of day because they save more money by not releasing it on tax write-offs or whatever as losses. Like, this is not that far off to see, you know, Microsoft tightening its belt and just letting things go, letting important artists go when they've been nothing but buoying their bottom line, or at least their brand, right?
Well, games were seen as a big investment during the pandemic, obviously, and that's the crater now when everyone's moving in on AI. AI is the cheap money to be made, and so there's drop everything else. It's yeah, very unfortunate. It's just this whole, I mean, not to say capitalism bad, that's a big discussion, but it's particularly egregious right now in terms of just the incompatibility of trying to make art, like video games as art, in this sort of capitalist scene is just getting harder and harder right now, as these monopolies just try and consolidate more and more power in one place.
Yeah. So, you know, I don't want to speak too much more about it because I'm not an industry expert.
Yeah,
Other news platforms have done it really well. But I'll just say from my perspective, I am going to try and be more judicious. I'm going to be trying to be like less naive and less, you know, more open-minded or more clear-eyed about some of the spin that these corporations are trying to sell us. Like, none of them are your friend.
No.
None of them are looking out for your best interest. And none of them are even looking out for the industry's best interest as a whole. So, you know, like, I'm even considering, like, letting my Game Pass Ultimate subscription lapse, which I had considered before.
We're obviously big, I'd say, advocates, we're big fans, at the very least, of Game Pass here. But, I mean, it was always, you could see it, that it was a loss leader to build that monopoly, right? The same as Amazon and every other big monopoly. And then the other foot was always going to come down. Yeah. And unfortunately, that seems to be happening now. So I've been trying to be a little more intentional about what I play and where I spend my money. It's... there is a huge number of indie games coming out right now, and I think which we're going to get to later in this episode. So that is the sort of the silver lining right now. I think it's a good time for indie games, but that way AAA and even like double A games are really struggling out there right now. But in the meantime, you can support your favorite indie studios.
Yeah, I think I will. For the time being, I'm going to stay on Game Pass. You know, I'm sad about Hi-Fi Rush, but to be honest, like, I would have never played it if it wasn't on Game Pass.
Exactly, that's a tough thing, yeah. And, that was how Microsoft marketed it, right? It was a shadow drop, I seem to recall. Like, they just dropped it there with no marketing. And then were upset that it didn't perform as well as they wanted it to. It was like, it was their marketing, right? That was their responsibility.
Right. And how can you sell something that you're giving away for free as part of your subscription? The other thing is, I want to maybe in the future bring light to other platforms a little bit more. Not to say that they're entirely golden either. I, you know, I'm consistently impressed with what Humble Bundle is doing, not in terms of the bundles, although I love those as well, but in terms of their publishing arm. And there's quite a few more that are like indies that I would have never been brought to my attention if they weren't promoted so strongly by Humble Bundle and, you know, made more available once they met the light of day on other platforms like Game Pass.
What's the games journalism also collapsing right now? So getting the word of mouth out about those smaller games is a lot harder as well when they're all focused on what sites are left. Are all focused on SEO or whatever of the new big hotness, right? So,
right, yeah. If it's not Pal World or Hell Divers 2 or Baldur's Gate or what's the latest one now? You know, it was Fallout 4 for a hot minute there, right? Like,
if it's passed already.
Exactly. If it's not one of those big titles, then it doesn't get the light of day. Even though I love indies, so.
Yep. Anyways, we'll be covering this later in this episode.
Yeah, that's right. We'll continue to
next episode. Next episode.
We'll do the work. That's right. How about yourself? Do you have any other more brighter news out there?
No. Why don't we jump over to the playlist and what we've been playing lately? Speaking of indie games.
Yeah, yeah. One last thing. I'm just literally going to say just one sentence about it. Mm-hmm. a new video game podcast was brought to my attention. It's called What's Good Games. This has been around for like years, apparently. Totally unbeknownst to me. Flew under the radar. But they're doing some really good stuff. And they actually do like game industry news. Mm-hmm. And they do it regularly. And they do it well. And like us, like our podcast, they have a main segment. I think one of them I listened to recently, they had an interview with a representative from Women in Game. Mm-hmm. And the current hosts of What Good Games are both women in the games industry.
Oh, cool.
They have they have a very fun, familiar tone, but they obviously know their stuff because they're in the industry. So I think we're just two like cishet dudes talking about games, and there's too many of those in the world. So I think any podcast that's out there that's representing less visible people, especially women in the games industry, I think is really valuable. It's providing a good service too, providing game news. So I'm enjoying it and hope others will check it out too.
Yep, more diverse voices in games. I see Andrea Renee is one of the hosts who I've seen in at least guesting on other podcasts previously. So yeah, I'll see if I can schedule that into my podcast backlog. Was that awesome. So? What's good games?
What's good games?
Excellent.
There you go.
Well, what's good? What's good lately for you, Mark?
Just a bit of a mixed bag, kind of because I went on vacation there. What about Final Fantasy Tactics? So I had a hard choice of what to bring on my vacation. I didn't want to bring two portable game consoles. So this time I left the Switch at home, couldn't play Unicorn Overlord. And then I had this scare with my Lenovo Legion Go. I think I just brought the wrong charger because it has a high power drain, as you might imagine. Yeah, I think I just brought the wrong charger. So it just like died and none of the other USB-C cables I brought worked, so it just didn't halfway through my trip. Couldn't play any of the games, just had to drag it along, but I brought it home and it plays just fine. But because I didn't have access to my console of choice on the go, I just pulled out some apps on my phone and I had Final Fantasy Tactics. Obviously not a new game, but a game that I have had a love-hate relationship with. I really love the idea of it. I really love everything, the story, the production, the the gameplay, but I'm just not good at it. I'm not good at those tactics games, other than the first, like, you know, four chapters or whatever. I can't grok the high-level gameplay of how all the various character classes and level up and build strategies work for that game.
Mm.
But I want to get better. I guess playing games like Unicorn Overlord, or even games like the, we mentioned briefly, Eiyuden Chronicles Rising and 100 Heroes, just sort of like the team building games. Mm. Like Final Fantasy Tactics has been doing that for so long. And it's sort of like the granddaddy of the tactical RPGs. I know Tactics Ogre is actually the original granddaddy, but it's the one that sort of blew it up for me anyway. So I bought this game like three times over. I feel like I bought it on PS2, and then I bought it on PlayStation Vita, which I proudly owned, love the Vita, and bought it again for phone. Okay. And it plays surprisingly well. My kid has been using one of my old phones as a sort of a tablet replacement, and they also had it. So we were playing the same mission of Final Fantasy together as we were waiting in line for the plane to board. It plays really well, and it's really solid. And all I'll say is I want to get good at that game, but I probably never will. Maybe it's my lonely island. It's my deserted island game. Is I could probably invest like 10 years into that game and eventually get good if I wasn't so dumb. So, yeah.
It's been on my bucket list for a while. I did see that it was available on the phone, but I feel like it's probably the sessions are a little too long than what I'd want to be sitting on my phone playing. Yeah. Especially like on the bus, like limited, you want pretty short bursts, and I'm not sure, like with the phones, obviously games often don't have very good save states. Like,
that's right.
So probably not the best spot for it.
It's that is literally the largest problem with that game on the phone, is that because it's a remake from such an old generation, it doesn't have smart suspension.
Yeah.
So I was playing like a 40-minute session, and I was in the airport. I had to close my phone to to go up to the registration desk or something like that. And when I loaded it back up, I was booted out. I was booted back to the home screen.
Mm.
And that's a serious problem. Like, retro games need save states, and we're just so spoiled nowadays with like instant suspension on things like Switch, Xbox, certainly. With the dynamic memory and whatever, that just seems inconceivable. So that's a real bummer. But if you can take the time to properly play those sessions on, it's available on iPad as well. Unfortunately, you have to buy a separate app for that.
Mm.
But if you can dedicate the time to it, it's still solid game.
Yeah, I've been waiting for a good console remake of that one. I actually have the remake of Tactics Ogre sitting around here somewhere. I need to try out sometime.
Yeah, I need to as well. Right on. How about yourself?
Speaking of the latest hotness, I have been diving into Hades. So we spoke previously about Hades, and I wasn't going to jump on this. It's just entered early access. As you've no doubt heard everyone talking about this last week.
For sure.
So I generally don't like playing games at early access. Like, I very rarely revisit games. I want to get in, get out, and I very rarely have time to go back and revisit a game. So when I do experience it, I want it to be the full experience, right? But the more I heard about this, apparently the early access has more content in it than the entirety of the original Hades, or as it currently stands. It has... I mean, for one thing, it's just quite polished because it's based on a previous game, right? They're working with a very similar engine, very similar mechanics. So the core loop and the mechanics were already sort of polished, basically. So there's further iterating on that. So, and also just the nature of that game is a game that you kind of want to be revisiting. It's not one I want to sit and grind out a dozen runs. I want to just do one run at a time, and actually it is actually a pretty good game for revisiting a little bit over the course of several months and just pick away at it. So I think I'm going to treat it like that for a bit and just do a run now and then, see where I get, see as changes are made. I just before we recorded was able to beat the first boss, And there's not a lot of changes from what I've seen so far. Obviously, you're playing as a new character. You're now playing as Melinawe, Zagreus's sister. There is a pretty cool hook in that all the characters are new, or at least like Zagreus, Hades, the family from the first game are gone. They're nowhere in sight. Melinawe is in theory trying to find them, and something has happened. Kronos has done something bad, and you're trying to rescue them. But it's all sort of in media res. You don't know exactly what's happened, and you're trying to sort of piecing that together through those early parts of the game. So that's quite a good sort of driver at the moment, trying to figure out what's going on. A few new mechanical changes. You've got all the mechanics have like a hold the button down for like a stronger attack that uses mana. Melinawe is a witch. So you're using there's like a whole mana bar that you can hold down. Any of like the three different versions of attack can all be held down in various ways, and obviously they can also be comboed with all the various upgrades. So there's a whole new branch of things to be upgraded and comboed in different ways. So that's quite interesting. I think what do they call it? Basically you can form this big circle around yourself that can both lock enemies in or keep them out. And that's probably one of the coolest things against some of the enemies. You give yourself some space. Because it is quite... Melinawe is quite squishy, it feels like. And a lot of the enemies are very spongy. Like, they take a lot of hits, which is a little frustrating. Everything's a little bit spongy to take down. I haven't quite found many good builds yet. But I'm just enjoying exploring all the mechanics, meeting all the new people, lots of new gods to check out, and obviously many people are comparing their favorite gods in various ways. There's sure to be someone there to please every flavor.
Yeah, everyone be thirsty about Hades gods.
Oh yes, yeah.
It's a tradition, I suppose.
Yeah. But it's more Hades, and I was a little indifferent to the original one. Like, it's a very good game, I will say that. It's just the core combat never really grabbed me. I think partly that I was playing with mouse and keyboard. It just wasn't particularly responsive with that sort of isometric sort of food, like looking down on the diagonal. It doesn't really control very well. So I've got to set up an Xbox controller for the to try that and see if it works any better.
Yeah, I having only played Hades on Steam Deck, have got to say, you know, controller, this is probably obvious, controller is the way to go.
I got that feeling.
Obviously other action RPGs like Diablo or whatever, yeah, sure, mouse is the way to go, and controller is clearly secondary to that. But I think Hades sort of just kind of came about in the console/PC generation, kind of like co-released, right? So it plays wonderfully with the direct control.
Excellent. I'll give that a go and see if it works any better. I have had some people saying there's a little bit of unresponsiveness with like dodging and whatnot that I think people seem to think is a more of an early access issue than that's unintentional. So hopefully it gets polished up some more as that game goes on. But yeah, I'm sure I'll be playing a bunch more of that as it advances.
Great. All right. Speaking of janky controls, I'm going to dive into my other video game that I played on the flight to Vegas. It's one I've been meaning to try for a while. You know me, I like my factory building automation games, like Satisfactory. And I wanted to try this game called Hydroneer. It's Hydroneer, I don't know, whatever. Hydro, like water. And I was like, I know that this game involves pipes and something like that, so I guess I'll try that out. And I was surprised to start up the tutorial. I played just past the tutorial, just into the first parts of the main game. And the game is surprisingly, like, it's sort of set in this, like, almost feudal world. Hmm. Like, the highest technology they have seems to be these sort of pumps. So that they have these sort of pumping machines of pumping liquid. And then they have, like, hand-drawn wooden carts, and they have shovels and like anvils, and they have cauldrons, and your essential. The goal of the game is to dig into the ground, to refine the minerals that you bring up, and to sell them into aids, and then that makes you more efficient at digging up the minerals and refining them into entitled of that resource, and then making more money, and then eventually automating that all away. And that's a loop that I love. It just hooks me. But I was just kind of like quite surprised at the approach of it, because, you know, Hydroneer, I thought this is going to be like kind of modern day. It's just going to be like pipes and cement and stuff like that. And it's very much not that. I feel like I'm kind of like in like medieval times.
Roman aqueducts.
Yeah, because like the first thing you do is like you have a shovel and a bucket and a brush. And I'm like, what the hell is going on? Right, like a pipe is like way further down the evolution chain. I was surprised at how sort of detail-oriented they are, because the initial loop is dig into the ground with a shovel, put it into a bucket, and you have to take a pan, like a wash basin, essentially. And how you control it is you pick up the pan and you drop it into the river. That's how you fill it with water. And then you pull the pan out of the river, set it on the ground, and then you dump the bucket full of dirt into the pan with the water. And then you take the brush and you brush the dirt in the water, and you gain an amount of resources.
Like gold panning or something?
Gold panning. Okay. The another conceit is the deeper you dig, the better the returns are. So you're going to get some rough things, like you're going to get some like iron ore or maybe some rough cut gems. And then through the various upgrades that you get, you can, you know, refine those gems and make jewels out of them. You can buy that cauldron and you can melt the ore and you can pour them into molds and you can make ingots out of them, essentially. And, you know, very, very typical stuff that you might imagine. But what struck me was how sort of awkward and obtuse the controls were. And I know that most of this was because I was playing on console controls, because I was playing on the Legion Go.
Usually designed for PC, these games, right?
Right. But what was further strange is it was perfectly controllable by controller. That wasn't a problem. I didn't need like a dozen hotkeys or anything like that. In fact, there's no hotbar or anything of the like. It seems like the design philosophy is in very, very much like simulating a sense of reality.
Yeah, right?
Like that's
frustration. That
yeah, exactly. It's surprisingly janky. Like one more extreme example I'll show, and it's not even that extreme. It's like when you trade in an amount of goods to get coin, you literally have to pick up each piece of coin. It doesn't just magically transport it into a virtual wallet that has like a digit at the bottom of the screen. You have to pick it up, and if you want to combine two piles, like it does automatically make piles, but if you want it to combine two piles, you have to just so carefully like line up your hand, which has like little,
so is it like Surgeon Simulator?
Kind of like it has a shadow that casts on the ground, and that's the only way you know where you're going to drop something. So I had to very carefully line up this gold in my hand with the gold coins in the bucket, and I had to place that in a bucket to pay for the goods that I was going to buy. And I had to put things carefully in the bucket and press a button to transact. And all of that could have been done away with even something as revolutionarily sophisticated as like a Legend of Zelda shop fit, or even like a 15-year-old Skyrim interface would have been.
But does this
more modern.
Are there upgrades that make this easier as you go? Because a lot of these games feel like they deliberately make things just so you can feel better when you eventually upgrade away from that, right?
But you can't upgrade buying an anvil from a store, right?
Okay,
like, so it's not like time. I'm gonna 1500 anvils per second from the store. No, like literally, like that's the choice that they made. Such a bizarre choice.
It's Anvil Merchant Simulator.
Yeah, so I'm gonna give it another try. But I just thought, wow, the brass spheres on these ones, like this is something.
I'm sure there's a market choice. For it out there somewhere.
Yes, like masochistic factory game players like myself. And how about you? Any more games?
Let's jump to the board game table in the sake of keeping this moving. Okay. I'm just going to mention one game. And last episode, I mentioned that I'd been playing Fallout 76. Everyone's talking about Fallout in its various forms. So I finally pulled off my shelf of shame a Fallout board game. That is Fallout Shelter, the board game. So this is Fallout Shelter being the app, based on the video game, and this is a board game based on that app, based on the video game. You get comes in this like really adorable tin. It's like a lunchbox shaped tin, which is very thematic for the, because like I think lunchbox is like one of the big collectibles in that game. And so this came out, I think, in 2020, so kind of slipped through a lot of radars for various reasons, obviously. But I was playing a lot of the app around then because my daughter had been born, had a lot of downtime, and it was a pretty. I really enjoyed revisiting that app as just a low key, like it's like a little ant farm game, right? You have rooms, you have little vault people running around the rooms. You can level them up. You can breed them in questionable ways, perhaps literally putting out fires. And so this is simulating that. It's basically a competitive worker placement game. You have a vault. You have a central elevator, and you've got it's like a grid of cards. Each card being a room in this vault, and each player has their own floor of this vault. And so you're building out rooms on your floor, and each room has little worker placement sections. So you've got these adorable little vault boys. You get seven of them, one for each of the special attributes. Like the
bobbleheads.
Yeah, basically they're all in the different poses, like the strength and the intelligence. And like some of these spaces will give you bonuses if they're leveled up in a particular way, right? So I think you double the resources if you match the attribute. But it's pretty simple. Basically, it's like three resources: your power, your water, your food. There's some cool themes in like water being much harder to get, like the push and pull of that. You're building out the vault. Because it's a worker placement game, but the cards you choose to build are what's going to give you those resources. So you're building the sort of economy and the engine yourself. And so there's some interesting worker placement there. You can visit other people's rooms, but they get like a free resource. And that's pretty simple, but like it's all has that same art style, that sort of cartoony Vault Boy animation that's very charming. So this is a great little aesthetic. One of the cooler elements, though, is that each round these dangers come up. Basically, you roll a dice, and on each floor, a monster or a fire will spawn. And most of these are like clear, basically transparent, with like just the monster on top. So you just lay it over the room, and you can just the monsters are standing in the room, right? So that's another cool thematic touch. But it also changes because the monster blocks that worker placement spot. So it changes round by round what spaces are available. And you can go out of your way to try and kill these monsters and to get some loot. So it's quite dynamic in it, how your options are changing, both building up new rooms and the monsters coming in. It's not particularly like unique in terms of mechanics. It's pretty breezy. It's one of those games where the theme is strong enough to sort of carry it, especially if you're a fan of the game, you're a fan of that aesthetic. It's a really cool sort of introductory worker placement game.
Yeah, I played the video game, the Fallout Shelter video game for a little while, and what you're describing sounds very familiar, and I can, you know, sort of picture it in my mind. It sounds like they did a really good job with sort of translating the video game, the mobile game, into a physical one.
Yeah, it doesn't have that quite sense, the same sense of like building out a space. It's just like room by room. Like there's no moving around the vault. It's like you can just go visit any worker placement spot on it, right? But each room is sort of represents a cool thematic touch. Like, oh, it's the diner where you get all your food, or the Nuka-Cola plant where you can get some water, and it has a lot of flavor. Quite a charming little box. I don't know how easily available it is now, but hopefully with the popularity of the show, it gets some more love.
Nice. Cool. I am going to mention a RPG which I haven't played. It's new to me, but it's a small little zine game. So I happened to read it all while I was on my flight. And I'm really excited about it. And I'm hoping that you will consider playing with it with me. So the game is called Rogue Zone. As far as I can tell, it's only available digitally. You can find it at DriveThruRPG or other places as well, I imagine. It's by a designer called Scragend, Scragend. But it's part of this Pocket Quests line, which I don't know if it's an official line. You know, like TTRPGs are doing interesting things with these new formats. And Pocket Quests is a thing that I vaguely heard about, so I decided to check this one out. It's regularly available for like under $10 US, around $10 Canadian, and it's recently on sale for half of that. So it's just about $6. So a real steal. Anyways, this is this PDF comes in at a whopping 25 pages, including cover and character sheet. And it's called Rogue Zone because the concept is it's like a roguelite. It's like a roguelite TTRPG, which is something that obviously people are trying. We play tested that game that our friend Quinn Brander is designing, which is a roguelite. And this is sort of very much like that. It's for 1 to 2 players, and you are playing these kind of who are called like zoners. They're sort of post-apocalyptic wasteland survivors.
Like Stalker, you know, is it? The Zone?
Perhaps. And there's this sort of like your favorite exclusion zone.
Yeah.
And of course, you're leaving relative safety, going into the exclusion zone, and every step you take deeper into the zone draws you closer to potential riches, but also great danger.
Oh, it's absolutely Stalker. Okay, yeah.
Yeah. So all of this is in conceptually very new. But I think this game like does a great job at sort of encapsulating some of these tropes and making a very stylish product out of them. All the rules totally make sense. They've commissioned some great graphic design. There's about 3 or 4... Actually, even more, like every page practically has this beautiful custom artwork, some interesting character designs. The design is not stereotypical at all. It's very like beautiful to look at. The graphic design of these new zine RPGs are nothing to joke about. Like just a super treat just to look at. It looks like basically like a high-end magazine or something. And they spell it out on this one page, on page 11, the gameplay loop. I'll try and share some of this on the video. You create a character, you're at your base camp, you enter the zone, you roll for weather, you enter a hex tile because it's also doing this subgenre called hex crawls. So you move from hex to hex and you basically try and discover notable things. And, I guess a board game comparison would be to relate it to something like Dead of Winter. I don't know if you've played that game at all.
So scavenging for resources. Yeah,
precisely. Yeah. You're scavenging, and in that game, obviously, you're fighting against zombies, but there's this constant tension between searching more and then risking making noise.
Bit of push your luck, yep.
Right, which draws the attention of more threats. And in this game, you search. More searches you do raises the enemy alert level, and if you manage to avoid it, great. You can escape without a problem. But if you draw too much attention, then of course you're getting into encounters, combat encounters. And then you basically repeat. You head back into base camp, you level up, you equip up, and then you're right back at it. So I'm hoping that this could be a cool indie sort of very board game-like experience for a tabletop RPG. Yeah, and it's for 1 to 2 players. So if anyone is interested and doesn't have a partner to play it with, you can always solo it.
Excellent. Yeah, as you say, I do love a good exclusion zone, though I do tend to prefer it when it's more about the sort of inexplicable strangeness of the zone rather than just fighting zombie mutants. So I'll have to see what tone it takes.
You think it would be just about fighting, but there's plenty of weirdness.
Excellent.
This game certainly has a lot of personality, and a lot of the encounters are not just combat.
Excellent.
So there's a whole page about it. And even things like the weapon descriptions are like cool and cute. The sort of like cyberpunk-y enhancement you can put on your characters are mechanically interesting and also cool. It just really distills things down into just something I'm super excited about, way more than, you know, your latest, like, I don't know, 200 page D&D expansion or something like that. It's just that doesn't have any hold any interest to me.
Yeah, this one much easier to actually read through and get a game set up. Yeah, right. I have a couple of RPG zines came in recently too, so maybe we can make a day of that and try a couple out.
Sounds good. Maybe we'll do a double header of one of those, a couple of those someday down the road.
Yeah, that sounds fun.
Yeah,
excellent. Well, I think we about done for the playlist.
Yeah, let's end this episode, I guess.
Excellent. Well, we'll come back next week for our featured our double feature of Harold Halibut and Botany Manor. So stay tuned for that. But if you have any questions, comments, you can join the club and email us at omnigamersclub@gmail.com or at omnigamers.club.
That's right. We're always interested in hearing your feedback, and tell us if you played any of the games we've been talking about, or if you have some new ideas for ones we can check out in the future.
Yeah, because I excited to hear about what indie games everyone's playing. As we mentioned, word of mouth is big right now. So yeah, tell us what indie games you're enjoying lately.
All right. Tune in next week to hear our main topic.
Excellent. Thanks for listening.
Thanks. Bye.